Any comments or questions? Anyone?
You talked about primary emotion of love and seven secondary emotions. So often we see that in trying to build some relationships, it's when the secondary emotions are dominant, especially like fear, fury, and so on, it's extremely difficult to build that primary emotion or nurture it. What are some of the things that you would recommend?
One basic thing is look beyond secondary to the primary. The primary is very strong. The secondary is seen as it is. It's a transient phase. Now, our the material realm is described as being a distorted or perverted reflection of the spiritual realm. In the spiritual realm, love exists purely, and relationships are existing purely. And in the material realm, they're distorted and disturbed. One of my favorite examples from the Vedic perspective is the relationship that Krishna had with Grandfather Bhishma. Now, those of you that are from India, you know who Grandfather Bhishma is. Those of you that are not, there were five brothers whose father died shortly after they were born. So they were raised by their grandfather. Their grandfather was like their father. And their grandfather took care of them, taught them everything, not just material, you know, went to work and got a job and paid it, but he nurtured their lives. So they had such affection for him. Now here was a situation that unfolded later in their adult life where they were on opposite sides of a battle. And the five brothers were saying, forget it, we can't fight against our grandfather. No way we can do that. Skipping events led up to the battle began. And there was a circumstance where the grandfather, Bhishma, was being told by the main party on the other side, look, you're not even trying, because you have this affection for these five grandsons of yours. You're not fighting to full capacity, and you're one of our chief generals. Come on. So he said, all right, I'll take your challenge, and here's five arrows, and tomorrow I will destroy the five brothers with my five arrows. I take a vow, and everybody knows when Grandfather Bhishma takes a vow, it's fulfilled, because he's this vow-keeping person. So Krishna knew that happened, so he made a trick. Skip the details, but he extracted the arrows, got them back. So that when Grandfather Bhishma woke up and said, okay, where's my five arrows? The person who he entrusted them said, oh, Krishna made a trick. He took the arrows away. Grandfather Bhishma was angry, furious, fury. My vow has been broken? Very well. I'll take another vow that either Krishna will break his vow, I'll kill his dearmost friend, Arjuna. So he fought furiously. So furiously, Arjuna was going to be killed. So Krishna broke his vow. His vow was he wouldn't fight. And as Grandfather Bhishma was getting ready with his arrows to kill Arjuna, Krishna picked up the broken chariot wheel and began charging at Bhishma Dev, smashing with the wheel. Bhishma Dev was in ecstasy. He just drops his weapons. He was so happy. So the relationship with the primary relationship between Krishna and grandfather Bhishma is Sakya, friendship. Excuse me, Dasya, servant. How can a servant try to kill the best friend of the one who was his lovable object? Chivalry eclipsed that primary emotion. But even when that chivalry was going on, the primary emotion was Krishna should be pleased. And Krishna was very happy to protect his devotee Arjuna and break his promise. That's where things are pure. And where things are impure, it's all distorted. And we get lost in the temporary, but even the love, that the feelings that one has for another on the temporary platform, that's also transient and impure. Even that, it's there's a selfish basis to it. So get to the spiritual platform of recognizing who the other person is, develop affinity and care and appreciation and affection for the person on the spiritual platform, and remember the primary relationship is my and their relationship with the Supreme. So while some impure or secondary emotion is going on, stay with the primary emotion even in the midst of all those things. So, yes.
Maharaj, thank you for your presentation. I was thinking about all the people that I've known that have been in communes. There are so many that went in with the best intentions to make it work. And none of the people I've known have had them last. Not a commune lasted. And my take after studying them is that the person, there's always a center person in the commune. They pretend to be democratic, but there's actually always one person who's keeping the whole thing, who is the soul of each one. And the reason why the communes failed, after seeing this presentation, is that the center person was not purely giving everything to God. There was some material motive behind there.
I'll share one back with you. In Hungary, the country in Europe, Hungary, there's a community that's based upon or is dedicated to being eco-friendly. And Poland and Hungary in Eastern Europe have been the breadbasket of Europe for a long, long, long time. Other places also, but primarily those places. That's their thing. It's their service to the rest of the European community. So the governments, well, people in general in Europe are more frugal and more conservative about how they use the resources that God has given them. In America, just use as much as you can and find some other place to get more that you don't have. Europeans are far more considerate about, so its sustainability is a big issue, especially in modern times. Sustainability is a big issue. So the government in Hungary is interested in finding successful models where sustainability sustains, and eco-friendly is really how people live. And they haven't found anyone except one. And the same, you know, they start with good intentions, but it doesn't endure. So they ask, you know, so the government's giving grants to, you know, work on this project, work on that project, because they want to grow success. So they ask him, what makes the success here that's not happening other places? God's at the center. That keeps everything going. The principles that we live by are sustained and supported because it's not, I just buy into it today and give up on it tomorrow. It's their enduring principles. And the adhesion keeps it going. The adhesion of dedication to the Supreme. It's fully natural.
Why so many are missing the point?
The answer to that is the very reason that we're in the material world to begin with. We have some issues. And one of those persons we have issues with is with God. That's why we're here. Yeah.
We live in America, in a society where it's very obvious that few people actually realize that God himself is behind everything else. So is it possible to be in pure relationships with people who
don't know that necessarily?
Yes.
It's certainly possible to live your life that way towards them, and then in that case you don't have an expectation. What happens in some cases, not in all cases, that by living towards them as a, you know, without expectation, but in a you know, seeing them as their spiritual identity, that brings that out. There's this innate spiritual dimension in every living being. And how that innate spiritual dimension comes out best is through association. A good example is, take a piece of carbon, like a spark that's kind of gone out, bring it back into the atmosphere of a fire. What happens? It starts to glow again, because that's just nature. But over there, it's not glowing, just hanging out, piece of carbon. So when in contact with a spiritual connection, at least the opportunity is there to come out. Because some persons are very determined. They don't want that. But often often it's due to some hurt. Somewhere along the way they've been hurt really badly and they're holding on to that hurt. So they can't open to something that's in the best interest. They're being protected, so there's a ways of doing it. And so what do you do? Just keep sending. Yes?
Sort of related to that situation, I think that the downside of what can happen is that, like, if you are in a relationship with a person who doesn't, like, you know, view things the same way you do, that you run the risk of sort of, like, giving so much and trying like so hard to, you know, treat them how you want to be treated, but if you're not getting it reciprocated, like, you can end up being more hurt and more drained for having, you know, spent all that energy on a person who's just not even trying to, like, give it back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just kind of wondering what your take is.
Two things. One is one of the things that Mother Teresa said. It doesn't need to change your disposition or regard for that person as, you know, like caring. Second thing is, so that you don't have to change, but the second thing is, it's natural that you will be discriminating. Not like feel badly or feel hurt or drained, as you described, but here's a person that by their choice, it's very clear, maybe circumstantial, their own, you know, hurtful circumstances in their own life, but they can't, you know, they can't reciprocate. So I'll continue to be kind, but I want to grow a garden.
I want to be in relationships that are reciprocating and watch the garden grow. And maybe if that person sees the garden is growing, they'll move from that stuck position to at least want to. And because they still have appreciation for this other individual on the soul level. So this gets into a whole thing of expectations. We had recently had a lively discussion about expectations. That expectation is our own issue. It's our own stuff. So the expectation part is I want something back. Now, if somehow our consciousness can elevate to a more spiritual position, it's what's in the interest of the object or the Supreme. What does the Supreme want with this person? The Supreme isn't going to interfere with their free will if they're just saying no, 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 more or less. So we don't interfere with the Supreme, but then someone who's saying yes, 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 instead of no, 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 then that will, we can be an instrument of the will of the Supreme to assist that person. So the expectation changes as your consciousness becomes spiritualized. The expectation goes towards that third party, the Supreme. What is it? It's their will. How can I act as an instrument of their will, rather than fulfilling my own expectations? And if I don't get my expectations fulfilled, I'm disappointed, or as you said, drained. So where are we getting our energy from is going to determine whether you get drained or not. The drained is when you have your own expectations. You don't get drained if you're on another channel of where your energy is coming from. It energizes you. And then when you're giving on that platform, it's truly selfless. You don't have an expectation. That's nice. It's very nice. And it's not dependent upon conditions. Take it up a little level and say, you know, sometimes somebody is reciprocating, sometimes they're not. And then I go through my phases because sometimes they're reciprocating and sometimes they're not. And again, that means it's my stuff, not theirs.
I think it's like when it's like a violent or abusive relationship.
That's another thing.
You know, you can't.
You step out of it.
Yeah. How do you like know where to change from, you know, be kind anyway to?
Well, be forgiving at least for the person that's. Because when somebody is acting violently and abusively, what's the pain that's inside them that's causing them to act that way? They're suffering a lot. And because they're suffering a lot, they're venting it on others. You just happen to be one of the others that's around them that they're venting it on. It's not just you, it's others. Plural. They're pained. So you can feel forgiving and compassionate towards their pain, but not leave yourself in, you know, the getting lashed at position. You can still feel compassion and care and appreciation for the soul when the behavior is unacceptable. Anything else?
No rush.
Yeah.
Thank you for a lovely presentation. I'm getting off the subject, but sometimes the college kids and students will ask, who is Srila Prabhupada? Who is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Maybe you can give a short statement on Prabhupada's mission.
Is that appropriate for our audience?
No.
Looking. He wants to hear. We're getting a who is Prabhupada question. Is that going to be good for this group?
This group.
Okay. Does anybody not know who is Prabhupada? You don't know. Is this your first time you've come to one of these gatherings?
Third.
Prabhupada is the one I heard that description about, you know, the body of the pond of water and the. He was born in India, and when he was 70 years of age, he came to America at the request of his spiritual master. He didn't request him when he was 70, he requested him long before, and he prepared himself to come to the West and give teachings of devotion from the Vedic wisdom, ancient teachings of India, to give that to the English-speaking parts of the world. So his mission was to give that teaching of love and devotion unto the Supreme to a group of people that never heard anything about Krishna before. Or, you know, there was some interest in Indian mysticism or something like that, but what it all meant, there wasn't really a clear idea. So he translated many books from the original Sanskrit writings to English, made very careful commentary to explain how those teachings can be applied in our life. And a very central part of that teaching was chanting God's name as the principal means of reawakening our original consciousness. So we do a lot of following him, we do a lot of chanting of Krishna's name, along with the whole lifestyle, like the vegetarian idea, but not just vegetarian. The foods that we eat are first offered to God, to Krishna. We take the remnants of that as sanctified foods. And try in everything that we do, at least the teaching is, whatever you do, make it an offering unto the Supreme. Sacrifice an offering unto the Supreme. See the world as God's creation, God's property, should be respected like that, and serve others in that same mood. We're parts of the same family. I just got a message from somebody in Detroit. A group of devotees in the Detroit Center are going to an old age home. The children in their community are going to go sing devotional songs, and the parents have prepared, you know, nice vegetarian food for the people, and they've, you know, little gifts to give to the old age home because they're, like, you know, they're alone and they're unhappy. Just as an outreach service. So whatever that is that people do, somehow place God at the center, and thought of God, remembrance of God should be at the center of all that we do. And then there's a whole teaching how to do that from Bhagavad Gita. That's all right? Simple. Yeah, I was waiting. I was waiting for your question. You usually have.
No, there are a lot of people in the world like us here, hopefully all of us here, who have this conception, and we live in this spiritual realm. And we put God in our center. Now we, through our teachings, through our passion, through our life, maybe we try to extend that toward everybody else in the world. But do you think that it would be possible ever, there's 6 billion people in this land, that we can live on that, I don't want to call it utopia, but what that video shows? Would it be
possible? It's not possible. It's not, in this age, it's not going to happen that all people on the face of the earth are going to live like that. No. It is possible that a small percentage of the people on the face of this earth will live like that. And if something that Prabhupada said was, if just number of times, like 20 times, gave the figure of 5%, now 5% of the world's population, that's a lot of people, but if 5% of the population lived like that, the whole planet would change. Even a much smaller percentage, and it's impacting the values of society in a very dramatic way. So, that's possible.
So then the other question, is it appropriate then to say that it shouldn't be a mission to go and push the other 95% or change the other 95%? We should let...
What Krishna advises in Bhagavad Gita is don't disturb the faith of others. Rather, be a good example. And by being a good example, that was one of the things that I was saying about, you know, somebody that's just like stuck. So you may reduce your investing of time and energy with that person that's stuck. Grow your garden. You go, wow, look at that garden. I'd like to grow a garden like that. And then get from the unstuck, or stuck to the unstuck position. Krishna, the name Krishna means all attractive. The syllables in Sanskrit, Krish, means to attract. So that's what Krishna does. He attracts. And as servants of Krishna, we should try to attract the hearts and the minds and the free will of living entities to go to a position of purity. Go the other direction and you get stuff like the Crusades and holy wars and, you know, abuse. So that's not, we're talking the opposite of abuse. Attract by purity. Yeah.
In the Vedic teachings, is there any talk of a great awakening as in the other major faith paths?
Sure. There's periodic ones called the Satya Yuga. That's another 427,000 years from now. And also within this present age, there is opportunity within the present age for that great awakening. It's called the Golden Age, or those who take full shelter, even when conditions are... The forecast is deteriorating conditions, but even within those deteriorating conditions, there's reprieve for those who take shelter of the Holy Name and the teachings of pure devotion. Not everyone will experience that, but some will at least have the opportunity for the next 10,000 years. That's described. From the time that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared till the next 10,000 years, the special reprieve in the age of Kali, and then after that is the sharp drop off. And the lives of many, many people have been completely changed. Their experience and their values and just, you know, their spirit lifted. Otherwise, 427,000 years from now, and what happens with that, as long as we have a lull here, that 427,000, with the end of this age, that conditions become so degraded. It's detailed in the Bhagavatam what happens at the end of this age, that an incarnation of the Lord comes and relieves all those suffering people of that condition of life. He liberates them, they return to the spiritual world, and then this golden age begins, where persons who are literally in higher dimensional realms of existence descend into this realm and begin this golden age. Because, you know, the slate was wiped clean. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Looks like we have some prasadam boxes to go back there. Yeah? Okay.